Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 34 says, "Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a disgrace to any people." Last week we began our thoughts on church and state as we were in anticipation of the election. Now we are on the other side of the election. Our country has made its choice and choices. And now we as Christians are moving into the mode of we'll have to make decisions over the coming years on how we will react to policies, how we will react to laws that are passed, how we'll react to judicial decisions made by appointees who are put in place by the people that we have elected for public office. And so I want us to continue to think today about appropriate ways for Christians to respond. And this whole idea of how does a Christian relate to the secular government. As we think about our country and its future, and after any election, you have those who may be excited about the election, you have others who may be very sad about the election. Wherever I find myself, how do I make decisions as a Christian on how I should respond, what's appropriate to do and what's not to do? That's what we began wrestling with last week. Last week we began to talk about this whole idea of what is the purpose of government. What is the purpose of the church? And we talked about that the purpose of the government is to protect the rights and freedoms of the people, to defend what is good, to promote what is good, to punish what is wrong in a society, that the principle on which it operates is justice. And that the purpose of the church is to promote the knowledge of salvation, and it operates on the principle of love. And we talked about that civil authorities are never commanded in the Bible to turn the other cheek. But we are. So as we continue to think about that tonight, what I would like us to do is I would like us to focus on Daniel for just a moment. Because I believe in Daniel we have a living embodiment of a follower of God struggling with the relationship between church and state. You may remember last week we talked about the fact that up until the Babylonian captivity, basically church and state, if you will, were one and the same in the nation of Israel. That all changed when they were taken away into Babylonian captivity. No longer was the power over them or the government over them guided by God's guidelines and God's rules. In 605 BC, the Babylonians began to take the people of Judah into captivity. Among those captives was a young boy around the age, probably 15, somewhere in his mid-teens, by the name of Daniel. And that would be the beginning of what we would know as the captivity, and basically the captivity would be dated from that moment. We have a second embarkment that's going to take place in 597 BC. And during that embarkment or that period of taking away of people from the region of Judah, a man named Ezekiel, a prophet, is going to be taken away to Babylon. And then a third group is going to be taken away in 586 BC. What's interesting is, in the book of Ezekiel, I believe it's in chapter 14 and verse 14, he gives an example of three great men of righteousness. And what he's doing is he's basically saying is that a few righteous men are not going to save a city that has lived in wickedness. Those righteous men can save themselves by their righteousness, but the city itself will still be punished. And so he says, even if Noah or Job or Daniel lived in the city, those men by their righteousness might be saved, but the city will not. And what's fascinating is that Ezekiel is a contemporary of Daniel. And he is talking about a man who is still living. In other words, it speaks to us of the reputation of Daniel, that he was a living legend. He was a spiritual legend, if you will, in his own lifetime. And so I want us to take a moment and look at this man who became a political figure in not one but two foreign powers. A man many miles away from home, serving under pagan rulers, yet who became an embodiment of godliness and righteousness. And I want us to quickly just highlight a few things that he did. A couple of things he did will serve to summarize and bring together some things we looked at last week. And a third thing he did will allow us to explore an area that I wanted to talk about just a little bit more tonight. Let's talk about a man who is in the world but seeks not to be of the world. The first thing I notice about Daniel as he served as a political official in the Babylonian Empire is that he served with integrity. Now, I am grateful that there are Christians. I am grateful that there are followers of God who are willing to run for public office and be involved in the political arena of our country. You may recall that last week we alluded to a number of people in the New Testament. We've got in chapter 16 a Roman jailer. In chapter 10, we've got a Roman centurion who becomes a Christian. In chapter 13, we've got a Roman proconsul who becomes a believer in Christ Jesus. Over and over, we've got examples in the New Testament of people from soldiers to commanders to political leaders to jailers who carried out Roman justice who became followers of Christ, and not only are none of them told to stop serving in those positions, but in the biblical accounts, we have evidence with at least some of them that they continued in that position after becoming Christians. And so from time to time, I've had folks come to me and say, you know, can a Christian run for political office? Of course you can. If it's a job you can do and honor God, then it's a job you can do. And so I'm thankful that there are folks like Daniel who are willing to serve in the political arena, even though they may be surrounded by folks who may not have the godly focus and morality that they need to have. But all of us can find ourselves in situations like that. In other words, can't you at the plant or in any other, at the school, you know, anywhere you work, aren't there people there who don't observe God's rules? Sometimes we kind of think that only in the political arena are there people that do things wrong. There are people that do wrong in every job. The key is, can I in that job do what is right? And what I notice about Daniel is that Daniel served in the political arena with honor and integrity. When he rose to power in the Babylonian Empire, the other political or potential leaders were jealous of his power and began to plot to try to bring him down. But I want you to notice what the text says. When the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs, but they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. We not only need Christians in the political arena, but we need Christians who will lead with integrity. If we find ourselves in those positions and we do not lead and serve with godly integrity, then we do more harm to the cause of Christ than good. So I want us to notice, first of all, that he was the best politician, if you will, the best governmental leader that he could be. He did it with honor and integrity. I also want us to notice, as we look at how Daniel interacted in the Babylonian Empire, that when he was commanded, even though as he functioned in that government position, he honored and respected the authority of the empire. He obeyed the rules of the land. And we talked about that last week, that God calls us to obey government leaders. Romans chapter 13 verses 1 through 7. He calls us to pray for kings and those in authority. 1 Timothy chapter 2 verses 1 and 2. He calls on us to pay our taxes. Jesus commanded that and Paul did as well. And so as you look at Daniel's life, he respected the authority of the government. But we also talked about last week that there were times when people practice civil disobedience when they were ordered to do what was wrong or they were ordered to stop doing something that was right, that was commanded by God. That they understood that the kingdom of God comes first.
that Jesus said all authority had been given to Him. They understood that any authority that governments had was delegated to them by God. That's what Jesus said in John chapter 18. That's what Paul said in Romans chapter 13. And so it is that we find that the wise men who were told to report back to Herod about the whereabouts of the Christ child practiced civil disobedience and did not report back to Herod. We talked about Peter and John who were told to stop preaching in the name of Jesus and they refused to do so. And so we find in Daniel that same practice. Daniel chapter 6, we know of the trap that was laid, the plot that was put in place. Basically, those who were opponents of Daniel worked to get the king to pass a law that they could only pray to him, that they could not pray to any other. And I want you to notice what the text says in verse 10. After the decree is signed and goes into law, I find it interesting how verse 10 words it to make it clear that he didn't do this out of ignorance. He knew exactly what he was doing. It says, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house, now his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God as he had been doing previously. Daniel was a man of character and integrity. He did an impeccable job in his role in the government of Babylon. But when he was called on to do something contrary to God's will, he refused to obey. As long as he was not asked to violate God's will, he was the best government official possible. But there was a line in the sand for him. There was a higher priority than obeying the king of Babylon. That was obeying the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. There may be times in our lives when the government calls on us to do what is wrong or to stop practicing what is right. And in those moments, even though it may require persecution, we must remember who our first allegiance is to. But the third area I want us to focus on involves the fact that Daniel spoke up to make sure that the thoughts and the morality of God were heard in the Babylonian Empire. In other words, he not only did his job with integrity, he not only disobeyed when asked to do what was a violation of God's will, but he actually worked to make sure that God's will was heard by the political powers, and even in one occasion was able to change the practices of the government. If you go to chapter 1 of Daniel, you're going to find that Daniel and his 3 friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are in a leadership training program that is being conducted by the Babylonian Empire. Basically what they did is as they conquered other nations, they would take some of the promising young men, often from prominent families, and they would put them into their education system and their training program and train them to be leaders in their empire. And so they would assimilate foreign peoples into their empire. And so Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are a part of Babylonian leadership training program. As a part of that program, they were fed specific foods. Now, it doesn't go into great detail about what these foods were. It also, in the text, doesn't go into great detail about what it was about the food and the wine that Daniel and his friends had a problem with. But the text does say in Daniel chapter 1 that in verse 8, Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Again, he doesn't go into detail about what it was about this food that was defiling. The issue I'm concerned with today is not why he had a problem with it, but the fact that Daniel felt like eating this food and drinking this wine in some way was going to defile him and in some way was going to defile God and His commandments and was going to interfere with his relationship with God. So I want you to notice how he responded to this. I want you to notice that he respected the system that he was in. I want you to realize that he didn't get up a rebellion. He didn't go with a bunch of the other guys and say, listen, they're trying to get us to defy God. Let's get a bunch of swords and let's read a rebellion. Okay? That's not what he did. What he did is he went to the man who's in charge of his training program. And he sought permission from the man in charge of his training program to change the rules for how they trained and fed the leaders in this governmental program. Well, the man who's in charge basically says, I'm afraid of the king. And man, if I don't give you the good food, I give everybody else, and you start looking sickly and poorly, then the king's going to come down on me. And so Daniel says, okay, I understand, but could we just do a little test? I want you to test us for a few days. Just feed us what we ask for and just give us a drink what we ask for. And then after so many days, if we don't look as good as everybody else, then you can act accordingly. But if we're as healthy or more healthy than everybody else, then let us keep on doing it. And so he says, yeah, okay, I can do that. We can handle a test for a few days. And so they do the test. And they pass the test, and they change the policy. I also find it interesting that if we keep on reading in the book of Daniel, you're going to find that there was in chapter 5, a wicked king by the name of Belshazzar. And Belshazzar is basically having a drunken feast. He's got 1,000 guests. And it's not enough that it's a drunken feast. But at this feast, he decides he's going to go and get all the precious utensils that Nebuchadnezzar had captured from the temple in Jerusalem. The temple, the very items that were used in the temple, made of silver and gold, etc., that had been captured and were put in storage by Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, his descendant, decides to go get those out and starts passing them around to his guests. And they start drinking wine out of them. So now they're not only getting drunk, they're getting drunk drinking out of vessels that were dedicated to God in His temple. And suddenly they see a hand that begins to write on the plaster of the wall. They can't translate the language. They didn't understand the meaning. And so the king becomes very, very afraid. And so he starts going to his wise men and his magicians, and he says, if you can interpret this, I'll lavish these gifts upon you, and I'll make you third ruler in the kingdom. But none of them knows what it means. And so finally, the queen comes and says, listen, king, it'll be okay. There is a man in your kingdom who has great wisdom in interpreting dreams. If you'll go get this man, I think he can interpret this dream for you. And so that man was Daniel, and they go to get Daniel. And so when Daniel comes before the king says to him, he says, I understand that you have a gift of interpretation and wisdom. If you can interpret the writing on this wall for me, if you can tell me what it means, he says, then I'll lavish these gifts upon you, and I'll make you third ruler in the kingdom. And Daniel says, keep your gifts, but I will tell you what it means. And he goes on to say in verse 18 of Daniel 5, O King, the Most High God granted sovereign grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar your father. Do you notice what he's doing there? He's emphasizing that no matter who the king is, how great or grand or majestic he is, he only rules by the delegated authority of God. He only rules because God lets him. That's the exact same thing that Jesus said to Pilate, when he said, this authority could not be yours unless it was given from above. That's the same thing that is said by Paul in Romans chapter 13 when he says that governments are supposed to operate as ministers or servants of God carrying out His justice in the earth. And so he does that, and he talks about how God allowed Nebuchadnezzar to rule. And he even talks about how Nebuchadnezzar had gone through a period of arrogance and God removed him from his throne for a time until he repented and he gave him the throne back. But then look at what it says in verse 22 of Daniel 5. Yet you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all of this. In other words, you're not like Nebuchadnezzar. He repented when God disciplined him, but you have been arrogant and have been unwilling to change. And so he tells him the meaning of the writing on the wall. He says, your kingdom has been numbered. The days have been numbered. It's coming to an end. You've been weighed in the balances and you've been found wanting. Your kingdom has been divided and is being given to the Medes and the Persians. And so after stating that, they lavish gifts upon him. He said he's the third ruler. And then that night, the Medes and Persians invade the kingdom and Belshazzar dies. And so he's third ruler for about, I don't know, a few hours. What I want you to notice about Daniel is that Daniel had the courage to speak out against the evils of his empire. He had the courage to speak for God and make sure the voice of God was heard even when it was speaking against the king. Sometimes people will say, you cannot legislate morality. Therefore, when it comes to laws that are made in the land, Christians shouldn't say anything. They shouldn't try to push forward their thoughts and their desires and the areas of what laws are made or and how those laws are interpreted by our judicial system, because you cannot legalize morality. I could not more strongly and emphatically disagree. Because my understanding, and I'm not a lawyer, so maybe you can get with Jason, and I know he knows a lot more about this than I do. But my understanding of law is that basically what law is codified morality of a society. It is a society that says, this is what we believe is right, this is what we believe is wrong, so let's codify it, legalize it, and let's write it down, let's have some official way for people to know what we view collectively as what is right and wrong. That's what law is. It is morals that are agreed upon by a society that are put in place by a legal system and then is surveyed and analyzed by a judicial system. In other words, if we pass a law that says, you can't steal my cat, that means that morally, somehow, we think it's wrong to steal somebody's cat. And so we made a law to make that moral, mutually held belief official for this society. If you don't make a law that says that it is wrong to steal a cat, then it can be interpreted that it's okay to steal a cat. Even in areas where you don't legislate, you may legislate by not legislating. In other words, if I don't have a law that says this is wrong, then it can potentially be interpreted that it is okay to do it because you don't have a law that is against it. And none of us want to live in a society where we don't have some kinds of laws. Okay? Because if we just leave it up to our individual morality, Rush may morally think it's wrong for me to steal his car. But I may morally think that, hey, first come, first serve. And if he leaves it in the driveway with the keys in it, it's my right. That may be my moral belief. See, we don't want to live in a society where everybody just decides for themselves. And that's why, in my opinion, societies have legal codes. They have laws. We, in order to live in a society together and have safety and peace, we need some kind of laws that codify what we believe to be morally right and morally wrong. So, in my opinion, every law that exists is in some sense a moral thing. It is a moral belief that's put in the books. If then law is in fact legalized morality, then my belief is you can't avoid legalizing morality. The question is not, will we legalize morality? The question is, whose morality will we legalize? As I look at Daniel, Daniel said, here is the law in the land of Babylon for how they train political leaders. I disagree with the moral code that underlies this law. I disagree with what they're asking me to do and my companions to do. So I'm going to do what I can to make sure that I don't have to break God's law. And I'm going to do what I can in my position with my power to change that law. And it may not seem like a big thing, but I wonder how many other people had been through this same program, had to eat the same food, and never did anything about it. They just went right on violating their conscience. Until a Daniel came along and said, I'm going to do what I can to change what's wrong with the system. And how many times do we see evil done in the nation and we say nothing? Daniel was unafraid to say, the king has erred. The king is arrogant. The king has sinned. When he saw sin in the kingdom, he spoke it. In other words, I don't think it's the church's place to pick parties and pick candidates by name. I think it would be wrong and a mistake, and it would be unfitting in light of the mission of the church for us to get up here and say, vote for this guy and this guy and this guy and vote for that party and that party and that party and only people going to heaven in this party or that party or whatever. But at the same time, I think we would also be wrong if we were silent when it came to the morality of our nation. That we would violate what it means to make the will of God known in the world. Paul said in Ephesians 3, the manifold wisdom of God will be made known to the church, to principalities and powers in heavenly places. As God's will is worked out among His people, the hosts of heaven and the hosts of hell see God's wisdom at work. But I also believe through the practices of God's people and the use of the God-given opportunities we have in our country that we can make God's morality known. If no Christians run for public office, then who runs our nation? If no Christians speak forth the morality of God when it comes to the laws that are made and judicial decisions that are made on the interpretation of those laws, then whose voice is the only voice left to be heard? Yes, it's true. We don't want a nation where they legislate what church you attend. We don't want a nation where they legislate how you're supposed to worship and put people in prison who either do or don't use an instrument when they sing praises. Likewise, we don't want a nation that gives specific laws about how you become a Christian. But when it comes to the morals of a society, every society has morals. And any society that survives for any period of time is going to have to establish laws based on those morals. And for Christians not to use the God-given opportunities to influence that system so that God's morals are heard in the process of deliberation, then we have buried our talents in the sand just as assuredly as the man in Jesus' parable. In Galatians chapter 6, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all men. I think promoting God's view of morality, which is based on a common love for people, because all people are made in the image of God, is a way to take advantage of the opportunity to do good. I think Daniel challenges us to realize that Christians can be involved in the political process if they do it with integrity. I think he challenges us to have the courage to say no when society says to do what is contrary to God's will. But I think he also challenges us to do our part to make sure God's voice is heard in our world. That His morals, His way of treating people, His understanding of life and when life begins, His understanding of what marriage and family is, His morality needs to be heard. I believe it was Edmund Burke that said, all that is necessary for evil to flourish is for good men to do nothing. Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? As you turn there, I would like to read for you a quote from our own James K. Polk. In his inaugural address, he said, "In assuming responsibilities so vast, I fervently invoke the aid of the Almighty Ruler of the universe, in whose hands are the destinies of nations and of men, to guard His heaven-favored land against the mischiefs which without His guidance might arise, from an unwise public policy." In other words, he's praying for God's help in the leadership of the nation, and that God would work to overcome even the mistakes that are made by those in power and the policies they make. One thing we need to remember is that the God who was God before every election is still the God after every election. And over the course of the centuries, He's allowed good leaders to ascend to power, and He's allowed bad leaders to ascend to power. But He is still King of Kings, and He's still Lord of Lords. And all of us, including every king and every president, will ultimately answer to Him. And so we ultimately put our trust not in a political machine or a candidate or a party. Our trust is in God. And as we seek to serve God, I think we need to recognize as American citizens that we've been given unique privileges to allow God's voice to be heard in our society in a way that it is not heard in most of the rest of the world. And I believe that is a gift from God. Let us not waste that gift or throw it away. But let us also remember that ultimately, that we are citizens of the kingdom of heaven. And nations of this world rise and fall, and America will be no different. But if we're a part of God's kingdom, if we, based on faith in His Son, have been baptized into His Son for the forgiveness of our sins, we became a part of His kingdom. And though every kingdom of this world will collapse and every rule will end, we will be a part of a kingdom that will reign forever. Because in the end, His kingdom has come, and His will be done forever with His people in heaven. If we can help you in your relationship with God, if we can help you in making God the ruler of your life or rededicating your life to God, come and let's help each other as we stand and sing.